Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what was the first song that Irving Berlin wrote, and what prompted him to write it? Philip Harwood is a film historian and lecturer who currently teaches film studies and media studies as an adjunct lecturer in the Hutton House Lectures at Long Island University, CW Post Campus. He also teaches at the 92nd Street Y and the JCC, both in Manhattan. He was coordinator for lifelong learning at Queens College, where he also programmed the annual Summer Film Festival, and he taught at the New School for Social Research. His essay, To Be or Not to Be, Jack Benny in Hollywood, 1940 to 1945, appears in the anthology, Well, Reflections on the Life and Career of Jack Benny, published by Bear Manor Media in 2007. Mr. Harwood recently gave a talk on Irving Berlin and the Hollywood musical at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York, and he later spoke with us about Berlin, who is widely considered to be one of the greatest songwriters in American history, and whose music forms an important part of the Great American Songbook. Thank you very much for speaking with us today. I'm particularly interested in the lecture that you gave recently, a presentation that you gave recently about Irving Berlin and Hollywood. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The program that I did at the Cinema Arts Center is part of a series that I do called The Jewish Composer and the Hollywood Musical. And primarily, composers like Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, Jerome Kern, these are composers who grew up in immigrant families. They primarily grew up in New York, even though Jerome Kern had more of a wealthier background than Irving Berlin or George and Ira Gershwin, but they all made money in theater, in musical theater. They primarily made money in musical theater here. Then, eventually, when sound came in 1927, they eventually went out to Hollywood to write songs for Hollywood musicals. And, of course, with Irving Berlin, a lot of his songs that he had written early in his career, because he had started writing as early as 1907, he would utilize his earlier works, his earliest songs, as well as writing new material. The same thing with George and Ira Gershwin. They wrote very few musicals together for Hollywood because George, unfortunately, passed away very young, at the age of 38. Due to a brain tumor in 1937. But a lot of his songs, and the songs that he wrote with his brother Ira, were used in other films, like Rhapsody in Blue, which is the life story of George and Ira Gershwin. Shall We Dance was written when he was still alive, but American in Paris, for example, has the Gershwin songbook. Funny Face, with Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn, is the title is taken from an earlier Gershwin musical, but the storyline is quite different. But they take a lot of the songs from that earlier musical. But primarily what Irving Berlin did and what these other composers did is they advanced the genre of the Hollywood musical with their music and primarily the American Songbook.
What prompted them all to go out to Hollywood? Was it just the idea of this new industry that was developing, or was there a reason why they wanted to leave, let's say, the stage, the theater musical?
Well, I believe it was one word, and that was money. Because keep in mind that a couple of years after sound came in, keep in mind the jazz single with Al Jolson came out in 27, so Hollywood was first saying, this is a fad, it may not last very long, but then they tested the waters, and they tread very slowly, building sound stages, for example, in Hollywood. So by 1929, you had this major output of musicals, all talking, all singing, all dancing. And then you had a Great Depression. You had a financial depression starting in October of 29. So what was happening on Broadway is that many people were not going to the theater because they just couldn't afford it. So the composers, like the Gershwins and Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern, they all said, well, this could mean money. We could make money. The daughter of Richard Rodgers once said that when you were a composer and you came out to Hollywood, you got a big paycheck, but the studios really treated you like dirt because they would, you know, cut the songs. They would take out songs. Irving Berlin did a musical in 1931 called Reaching for the Moon. And he had written five songs. Four songs were cut without his knowledge. And he said, I'm going back to Broadway. I'm going back. And eventually he came back to do Top Hat with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And that set the stage for his musicals in Hollywood. But Irving Berlin was the type of person who had complete control over his music. Keep in mind that Irving Berlin, when he was a child, he was a child of the streets. He left home very early, became a singing waiter, had no musical instruction. It was all, you know, when he wrote his songs, his 1,500 songs throughout his life, and I was asked about this at the Irving Berlin Program at Cinema Arts Center, is that he had arrangers who would write down the music and write down the songs. So he would call, and he was insomniac, so he called in the middle of the night his arrangers and say, I have an idea for a song, write this down. And he would write, you know, have the person write that song down. He believed in the beginning that he had to write one song every day. He had to write one new song, which he almost did. He almost did that. And he found that in the beginning he wrote with a lyricist named Ted Snyder. And he realized, if I write the songs, write the music and the lyrics, I can make more money. If I open my own publishing house, I own the rights to my songs, so I can make more money. Then he decided that instead of dealing with another producer like the Schubert Brothers, another theater owner, he would open his own theater, the Music Box Theater. And he said, if I own my own theater, I can be my own manager. I can, you know, call and produce my own musicals.
You said that he was a child of the streets and that he was self-taught, I guess. What influenced him? What made him become a singing waiter? Do we know?
We know that his father had been a cantor in Russia. And there was always speculation where in Russia he came from. His daughter said that he came from Siberia. So when he came here, his father had switched from being a cantor to kosher meat. Like, he wasn't a butcher, but like he would give the certificate of authorization that meat was kosher. And the father died when he was very young. So what happened was he left home, sold newspapers, lived on the streets, eventually joined the Pelham Cafe as a waiter, and he became a singing waiter. What he started doing is writing parodies of popular songs. Now, I say writing, he was actually jotting down the words, and then he would sing them in the cafe. What started him as a songwriter, in 1907, the owner of the Pelham Cafe learned that the waiter across from the other cafe across the street had published a song. So he said, you know what, I want to publish a song here. And his name was Israel then. He was Israel Berlin. He said, Israel, I want you to write a song that we can publish. So Israel's first song was Marie of Sunny Italy. And what happened was, on the sheet music, they misprinted Israel's name. It wasn't Israel Berlin, it was I Berlin. And he took the name Irving Berlin. But that's really what started him writing that one song. And then he wrote other songs. And then in 1911, he wrote Alexander's Ragtime Band. That started this whole ragtime craze. And he wrote one rag after, you know, the other and the other. Then he wrote his first Broadway musical in 1914. But this started this whole process of writing song after song after song. Then he became very wealthy. He became a wealthy songwriter. He married in 1913. His first wife was Dorothy Getz. I know we're going on a tangent now, but he married. She died 6 months after their wedding. She died of typhoid. But he wrote his first ballad, because he was had a mental block. He couldn't think. He couldn't write. His brother-in-law said, write what you feel, and he wrote When I Lost You. But that's really what started him as a songwriter, was just being a singing waiter, writing parodies, and making that into a career.
So if little by little he was able to, let's say, accumulate all these other businesses, I mean, you know, publish himself and buy his own theater and everything, right, obviously he was successful.
Very successful. But his main goal was to write the great American song, to write the great, you know, the take the songs and reach people's hearts with his songs. And his goal wasn't to say, I'm going to write 1,500 songs, but his goal was just to keep writing, because that's really what he enjoyed doing. And the money was good, but he just enjoyed the lifestyle that he had. And he always said, I don't want to be like I was as a child. I don't want to go back to the streets. And that's why he was also a tough businessman, in addition to writing the music. When he worked out a contract with Pandros Berman at RKO Studios, Pandros Berman said he was a very severe businessman. He really was very tough as far as the money, the contracts. When he worked out the contract for the film version of Annie Get Your Gun with Arthur Freed, who was the executive producer of musicals at MGM, Arthur Freed said it took longer to work out a contract with Irving Berlin for Annie Get Your Gun than it took him to write the musical. But it was always a love for the popular song, for writing the popular song.
And there are many of his songs that are total classics, and some of them are very, I don't know, I mean, you could say Christian. I mean, he did write White Christmas.
Well, that's the thing. He developed the concept in 1942 for a film called Holiday Inn, which eventually two servicemen saw it, and they started the hotel chain of Holiday Inn. But Irving Berlin had three daughters and a son who died prematurely on Christmas Day, 1928. So Christmas was always a sad day for the Berlins. And this is when he had already had been married the second time to Ellen McKay, that was his second wife. But he wrote the song White Christmas as part of a concept for the film Holiday Inn. He wrote other holiday songs. Easter Parade he had written originally as... It was originally a song in 1916, Smile and Show Your Dimple. And then he changed the lyrics and became Easter Parade for a musical called As Thousands Cheer. And that opened in 1933. So it became a big hit for Clifton Webb, who actually first sang it in the show. And then he put it in Holiday Inn, where Bing Crosby sings it to Marjorie Reynolds in that film. And of course you had the 1948 film of Easter Parade. But he wrote other holiday music. He wrote Let's Start the New Year Right, Be Careful It's My Heart for Valentine's Day. Again, that was written for Holiday Inn. He never wrote, and it's been asked why a Jewish composer never wrote songs for Passover, for Hanukkah, for Rosh Hashanah. And he was also trying to fit into the American mode. He was trying to be Americanized, Anglicized in a sense. He wanted to fit into that melting pot that, you know, he didn't want to say, I'm Irving Berlin, I'm an American, I'm going to write American songs. So this is whole backstory with Hollywood, where you had the moguls who built up the Hollywood system, the Louis B. Mayer at MGM, the Adolf Zukor at Paramount, you know, the Warner Brothers at Warner Brothers Studios, who didn't want to speculate on their true background because their families had escaped the pogroms in Europe. They were here, they built these empires, and they didn't want to say, we're Jewish. The children of these moguls said, we didn't know we were Jewish until we were adults. You know, they had Christmas trees in their foyer instead of a menorah, for example. So with Irving Berlin, it was trying to fit into that Anglo-Saxon, Americanized existence.
There's also been a lot of talk about anti-Semitism in Hollywood, even though there were so many Jewish people who were working there. Did these people who went out there, did they find anti-Semitism, or were they just afraid of it?
Well, they were always concerned about it, and I will give you an example. When Gentleman's Agreement was being produced by Darryl Ozanek, Darryl Ozanek was not Jewish, but he met with a rabbi and a priest, and, you know, Darryl Ozanek said, I'm going to release this film. He was met by Louis B. Mayer, by Jack Warner, Adolf Zukor, who all said, you can't make this film because it's going to bring attention to us. Mm. And there's a line in the film where someone, one of the magazine writers says, we'll deal with it in our own way. And in Hollywood, you had a major flux of people coming in from Europe, Jewish emigres, German-Jewish composers, writers. You know, keep in mind Franz Waxman, Bronislaw Kaper, Arnold Schoenberg. They all came from Europe, and they lived in Hollywood. So there was an atmosphere where they were accepted in Hollywood, but they didn't want to let on that we are Jewish, even though Franz Waxman wrote Judaic works. But there wasn't really anti-Semitism, but there was always that feeling, let's not show who we really are. Let's fit into the American mode. Like Louis B. Mayer, for example, at MGM created the Andy Hardy series. He took July 4th as his birthday because he never had a real birth certificate. Al Jolson never had a birth certificate. We believe he was born in 1886, but he took Memorial Day as his birthday because he entertained the troops. So you have these moguls and songwriters and performers who created their own existence because they didn't want to deal again with what they dealt with in Europe, and that was the pogroms. So they felt safe here, but they felt, let's not bring on the fact that we are Jews. Let's just fit in. Let's just fit into the American way of life.
So they didn't actually encounter any anti-Semitism.
No. There are no accounts of Irving Berlin, Jolson, coming in contact with that, because they were here. And even though there are reports that they're, you know, and I've done discussions on Gentleman's Agreement, everyone has their own stories of dealing with anti-Semitism or forms of anti-Semitism, clubs that would not accept them, for example, as members, comments, you know, people who are not knowledgeable in Judaism, who are not familiar with the holidays. And, you know, I would hear comments as a child of Rosh Hashanah, for example. You know, they would say Happy Hanukkah when it was Rosh Hashanah. You know, they wouldn't know, because I think there's just a lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in some cases we need people to have a better understanding. That's where anti-Semitism comes into the picture, that anti-Semitism is due to lack of knowledge, to ignorance, to fear, and that's where that comes into the picture. So when you have those elements, that's where anti-Semitism comes in.
I have heard that when they were in the 30s, when they were trying to decide on the national anthem, a lot of people wanted it to be God Bless America, and it was rejected, at least in part, because Irving Berlin, the writer, was Jewish.
There was a thought of it being the national anthem.
Certainly a lot easier to sing.
It's a lot easier to sing, and I've heard people attempt to sing America the Beautiful and the national anthem, but what they did do for Irving Berlin is they gave him the Medal of Honor. They gave him the Congressional Medal of Honor for writing God Bless America. There's always been thought of making it the national anthem. Maybe one day we'll see that, but it never came to be, you know, during his lifetime.
So you don't think anti-Semitism had anything to do with that?
I don't think so. I think it has to do with tradition of what we have sung as the American anthem. But, you know, the thing is that there are so many changes taking place now. You know, now the $20 bill will have a female rather than Andrew Jackson. So you never know. You know, every day there are changes. There are many changes being made. So I wouldn't be surprised maybe in 10 years, maybe that might become our national anthem.
Is there anything else that you would like to say that we might have left out?
Well, with Irving Berlin, I feel that he wrote songs that touched the American heart. And Jerome Kern said it best about Irving Berlin, that Irving Berlin did not have a place in American music. He was American music.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.